What an experience to come here and to see this wonderful independent media center already established. Congratulations to all of you. Oh, I just got a text message that says, Denise Lineman, age 46, of Bayside, killed in Iraq, U.S. servicewoman. It never stops. To be here at Christ Church, which I now understand is a historic church, a stop on the Underground Railroad, it takes me back to the beginning of this journey that we began on Labor Day weekend, as we began our 80-city Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, celebrating independent media that breaks the sound barrier. We began on Friday night of Labor Day, weekend. It was Provincetown, Massachusetts. We were celebrating WOMR, Outermost Radio. And the next day, we headed to Nantucket, took a ferry with Ernesto, the hurricane, not Che. And we got to Nantucket, and that was the end of the ferry service because of the hurricane. Now, we had made it to land, but we had to go on from there after giving a talk to Martha's Vineyard. So how would we get there to the Old Whirling Church that night? Well, the ferry service said, all of these are grounded. We can't use these in the hurricane, but you could take a plane. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a problem when it's too dangerous to take a boat in a hurricane to take a plane. But before we knew it, we were in one of those six or seven seaters where you sit next to the pilot. And she was saying, hit that button now. We made it to Martha's Vineyard, but then the trick was how to get from Martha's Vineyard to the mainland, to Providence, to fly to Chicago, where we would spend Sunday and Monday at the largest gathering of Muslims in the United States. It was the ISNA conference, the Islamic Society of North America. 40,000 people were gathered there. Now, I was traveling with Dennis Moynihan. He's the outreach coordinator of Democracy Now! And he knows Martha's Vineyard well because he lived there. And he knew, rain or shine, there is one boat that will make it to this island and leave. And that's the newspaper boat. People are hungry for information. So we went out in the driving rain at about 3:30 in the morning on the pier. And we watched this pinprick of a light bobbing in the Atlantic, coming closer and closer, bobbing in the Atlantic, in the waves. Finally made it to Martha's Vineyard. Dennis helped unload hundreds of newspapers. And then we climbed in and made our way into the Atlantic Ocean. And this was just the first weekend of this trip. The word is, Donna Lineman died in Kuwait, non-combat related, but all in that, as they call theater, it seems to me, is related to what's going on today. So, Nantucket. From Nantucket to Troy, the Underground Railroad. Nantucket. Nantucket is the place. Is that good? This closer? This one closer? I can do this here. Testing. One, two, three. Is that good? Is that good? Okay, very good. Media is important. Nantucket, an historic island. It's the place where Frederick Douglass gave one of his first addresses against slavery, for abolition. His body trembled when he spoke. He shook because he was speaking from his own experience. He had been enslaved as a child and a teenager. He was born on the eastern shore of Maryland. He had been handed over to a slave breaker. His name was Edward Covey, his property called Mount Misery. Other slave owners handed their troublesome slaves to this man to break. He almost broke Douglas, but Douglas broke away. He headed north and he changed the world. That property today, Mount Misery, is owned by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. It's his vacation home. He bought it in 2003 to be near his close friend about a quarter mile down the road on the eastern shore of Maryland, Vice President Dick Cheney. That's up to you to decide. That's what I was thinking about in Nantucket. The night before, we were in Provincetown. And I spoke at Provincetown High School. So we drove up, it was getting dark, and I was just about to mount the stairs, and there was this pickup truck right at the stairs. And as I was walking up, I saw that there was a coffin in the truck bed, and there was a couple standing next to the truck. Their names were Carlos and Melita Arredondo. And they spoke very quickly as I walked into the school to tell me their story. Carlos said it was his 46th birthday. It was August 25th, 2004. He and his wife had moved to Florida. He was with his mother at home. Melita was out. And a Marine van pulled up. He thought, could it be that Alex has come home from Iraq to surprise me for my birthday, his son? But no, the Marines came out and they informed him that Alex was dead. He died in the ancient Iraqi city of Najaf. He was 20 years and 20 days old. And Carlos lost his mind. He went into a frenzy. He asked the Marines to leave. They didn't. He begged them to leave. They didn't. He raced into the garage and he got out some cans of gas and a blowtorch. And he asked them to leave again and they didn't. And so he raced to their van and he started to try to wreck it. And he poured gasoline inside and he was ripping it up and his mother ran out to try to pull him out of the van. He had gas on himself as well. And that motion of pulling him out triggered the blowtorch and blew the whole thing up. At which point his wife, Melita, pulled up. And that's where she found her husband burning on the front lawn. And that's how she learned that her stepson, Alex, was dead. Their younger son, Brian, was on summer vacation in Maine. And he called his father to wish him a happy birthday. And someone picked up the phone. He heard this commotion. He heard something about the media. He turned on the television, and he saw his father burning on national television. And that's how he learned that his older brother, who he loved, who he emulated, who he wanted to be like, was dead. No judgment, just one story in a time of war. Well, it took Carlos a long time to heal. He was burned on over a quarter of his body. But the physical part was the easy part. It was the emotional part, the psychic part, that he continues to work on today. But a year later, in August 2005, when Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford, that's when Carlos found his voice. Cindy Sheehan. August 5th, 2005, she goes to the Dallas Veterans for Peace Convention. And she gives a speech and very spontaneously says, you know, I can't enjoy another vacation. Her son, Casey, died 4/04/04, April 4th, 2004, in Sadr City, Baghdad. And so she said she would head to where the president was vacationing to ask him a question. For what noble cause did my son die? She said, I mean, there she was in Dallas, in Texas. She didn't know where Crawford was, but she said, how far could it be? So the next morning, she headed out in a little caravan with some veterans, and they made their way to Crawford, and she took up residence in the ditch outside the presidential estate. We won't call it a ranch, because it isn't. She just kept asking for an hour of the president's time, the commander-in-chief who she said had sent her son to his death. Now, The White House press corps was there. They follow the president everywhere, not known for their independence. But beware of even this embedded press corps in the dead of a Texas summer, 110-degree weather day after day after day, not getting the access of evil they were used to. That's trading truth for access. With the president on one of the longest vacations in presidential history. And so here next to them was this relentless, persistent woman. And they took up her call and they asked the president. And this is the power of the press when it asks an important question. He has to answer it if they're serious about getting it answered. And they asked him, why won't you meet with this grieving mother? And he said, I have to get on with my life too. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported that day that he went mountain bike riding for 2 hours. He swam, he fished, he went to a Little League luncheon, and apparently they reported he did some reading. That was how he spent his day. He didn't have time, though, for Cindy Sheehan, and she wouldn't give up. Now, the press corps turned to her and said, you're so eloquent, you're so articulate, why haven't you spoken out before? And Cindy said, I have been speaking out, you just haven't been listening. Now, if you are regular Democracy Now! Listeners or viewers, how many of you listen to Democracy Now! Do you listen on WRPI? How many of you watch Democracy Now! You can watch on, where do you watch? It's on channel 375 of DirecTV, which is Link TV, one of the independent channels we're on. Where else? Schenectady Public Access, channel 16, every day at 8 a.m. That's live on Schenectady Public Access. And how many of you watch the podcast or listen to the podcast every day? Well, it's been amazing, this journey, not just of the last few weeks, but of 10 years. Democracy Now! Began on a couple dozen community radio stations, on Pacifica stations, and other college and community radio stations. And 5 years later, we expanded to television. And now we're broadcasting on over 500 public radio and television stations around the country. We're broadcasting on Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, low-power FM stations, both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375, video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are now translated into Spanish and transcript and audio form, so scores of stations around Latin America and in Europe, in the United States and Canada are taking our headlines in Spanish and broadcasting them. And Time Magazine just called Democracy Now! And Tim Russert's Meet the Press, the pick of the podcasts in this country. I don't know how Tim Russert made it up there, but. And 2 to 3 news stations a week are picking us up. There is a hunger for independent media in this country. By the way, on October 24th, I'm launching a new column called The Same Thing as This Tour, Breaking the Sound Barrier, to bring out the stories of people who I don't even think represent a fringe minority or a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media. It'll be syndicated by King Features, and any newspaper can pick it up weekly, and that would be up to you to call your newspaper and ask them to run the column. Also, as we attempt to reach out further and further, Static, the book that I wrote with my brother, journalist David Goodman, I'm lucky enough to have as my colleague, and I hesitate to use the word in this day and age, collaborator, my brother. So that's wonderful. But the book has hit number 8 on the New York Times political bestseller list, and has hit the North California Independent Booksellers Association bestsellers list, which is the collective of independent booksellers. We're proud to be working with Market Block Books today. We have come to deeply appreciate throughout this country independent bookstores as a critical part of the independent media landscape that we must preserve. And we've also hit on the main New York Times bestseller list, 20, 18, 22, it fluctuates each week. If we hit 15, then we will be printed in the pages of the Times in that list. We've hit the extended list. The top 15 get printed in the pages. And why would that be important? Well, because we are fierce critics of the New York Times. In our first book, Exception to the Rulers, we had a chapter called Lies of Our Times. And we think it's absolutely critical with the paper of record that sets the news agenda in this country, for it to act as a conveyor belt for the lies of the administration, basically mainlining the allegations of weapons of mass destruction in the lead up to the war. On the front page, above the fold, stories by Judith Miller and her colleagues. And she didn't do it alone because she doesn't get to place the article. She may write them, or her unnamed sources like Ahmed Chalabi may. But the editors put them there, so it's a collaborative effort, and it has to be challenged. Now, they're not going to review either book, but if we have enough books sold, it will have to be printed. So we encourage you to think about the holidays, buy two books if you want. And if you get two books, we have one of two DVDs. One is An Hour with Pete Seeger that we ran on Labor Day. You might have heard it on Democracy Now! Well, now you get to watch the actual TV broadcast. The other is a Harry Belafonte hour and a half when he came into our studio, and it was just a wonderful trip through the 20th and now 21st century with this incredible artist. Both are amazing. If you get four books, you get both of them. But anyway, also, just to understand the politics of publishing, it is very important that these corporate publishers understand that there is an audience, a readership, they call it a market, for these kinds of books. And every book like this that makes it makes space for another book. And also, unlike Market Block or the Bookhouse in Albany, a lot of bookstores just stock the bestsellers, which is a problem. Because a lot of good people go into bookstores to find something to read, looking, hungry for something different. And if they don't realize there's a lot out there, and I think Static is an introduction to that independent universe of media, then they'll only have that certain set, which is also another reason to get on these lists. Our title, Static, that we chose, is because in this high-tech digital age with high-definition television and digital radio, all we get is ever more static, a veil of distortion and lies, omissions and half-truths that obscure reality. We need a media of a different kind. We need a media that provides the dictionary definition of static: opposition, criticism, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. We need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. That's why we called it Static. So, back to Cindy, speaking out before, but not being noticed. If you listen to or watch Democracy Now! Or read the transcripts online, you know you had met Cindy before. Well, we were in Washington, January 2005, for President Bush's second inauguration. Cindy Sheehan was there. We were covering it for Democracy Now! She was there along with Celeste Zapala. Celeste lost her son, Sherwood Baker. He's the first Pennsylvania National Guardsman to die since World War II. And Celeste and Cindy and others founded Gold Star Families for Peace. And they tried to talk to Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. They called ahead to see if they could meet with them, these mourning mothers. They didn't get word back. They decided to make a pilgrimage to the Pentagon. They made it as far as the Pentagon parking lot. and where they met by an envoy of the secretary saying he's not available, but will pass on your message, or perhaps invited into the Pentagon on these cold, nasty days for a little hot cider and comfort. No, they were met by the black-clad Pentagon security, and they were turned back at gunpoint. Well, beware of mothers who have nothing left to lose. And so a few months later, Cindy headed to Crawford, which will now forever be known as Cindy's Crawford. So as Cindy waited for some presidential FaceTime, she became a magnet for hundreds of people, thousands who came to Crawford, like Nadja McCaffrey, whose son is Patrick McCaffrey. And after 9/11, he felt like he had the perfect life, his wife, his two kids, and in a time of attack or natural catastrophe, he wanted to serve his country, and so he signed up. Well, he was called up to go to Iraq, and he had to make a decision. He didn't understand the connection. He sat with his mother, Nadja. She didn't want him to go, but he felt he didn't want to desert his buddies. He at least wanted to protect them, so he went to Iraq. Now, we all here live in New York, and our governor is George Pataki. Now, he visited Iraq, and he came back, and he said he wants to take a piece of the statue of Saddam Hussein and embed it into the foundation of a new World Trade Center. If he does that, it will be the first proven link between 9/11 and Iraq. Well, Patrick went to Iraq. He wrote home for soccer balls, deflated soccer balls, and candy for the Iraqi kids. Ultimately, he was killed there. And when his casket was sent home, Nadja McCaffrey, his mother, called out all the press to come to Sacramento International Airport, a defiant act. Why is that defiant? Because President Bush invoked the executive order that says you can't film, photograph, videotape the flag-draped coffins of soldiers coming home. And she encouraged the photographers to snap away. She told the videographers to turn on their cameras, and she encouraged the filmmakers to film. She said, "My son didn't go to Iraq in darkness. I don't want him coming home in darkness." That's how she chose to memorialize her son. She headed to Crawford. Then there was Patricia Roberts. She lost her son, Jamal Addison, in Iraq. I believe he was the first Georgia National Guardsman to die since World War II, and she set up a fund so that young African Americans would not have to detour through Iraq to get a college education. And then there was Becky Lowry. She's a state senator in Minnesota, and I learned about her two memorial days ago. I was giving the commencement address at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin, and I was driving through Minneapolis, and I picked up a copy of the Pioneer Press. And there was an article with the headline, "Death in the Family," and it was about Becky Lowry. She had introduced an anti-war resolution before the invasion. She had confronted Donald Rumsfeld at a national conference of state legislators around the issue of no-bid Halliburton contracts being no good for the soldiers in Iraq. But that's not what this article was about. It was about the fact that that weekend, two memorial days ago, she lost her son, Matt Lowry, in Iraq, and she headed to Crawford. Of course, Democracy Now! Headed there too, this daily, grassroots, global, unembedded, independent, international news hour to talk to people who were there, not to have those pundits in Washington that we see on all the networks comment on the hinterland, that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We wanted people speaking for themselves, and we talked to all these women. And Becky Lowry said, "With our children dying, who will be our future leaders?" Well, I think Becky and Nadja, Patricia and Cindy, these are the future leaders of this country. Back to Carlos, who was inspired by what was happening in Crawford, and he decided his act would be to drag a coffin around the country. So he went to Crawford and Waco. He dragged this coffin over Capitol Hill. Sometimes he'd take a miniature one, sometimes he'd take a full-size one. And he came up to Provincetown, where I met him. And you should have seen it. He brought this coffin down Main Street, and everyone stopped. This is Labor Day weekend. Everyone is having their last big bash before going back to work and to school. And here is this coffin coming down the street, and people stop. And Carlos says, the war's not on vacation, neither am I. And he had all of these documents, and I leafed quickly through his loose leaf, and one of them was a letter. Carlos and Melita said that they are aggressively recruiting their younger son, Brian, to go to Iraq, the Army National Guard. And I saw this letter. It said, Dear American. And that was interesting because Carlos is not an American citizen. He is from Costa Rica, where they don't have an army. But he wants to be an American citizen. He's applied for American citizenship, but he is, he said, continually denied. It is not as if he hasn't given the greatest sacrifice any American could give, more than his own life, the life of his child. But he just hasn't managed to merit it yet. And the letter goes on. It starts by saying, if you sign up, you can serve in situations like Hurricane Katrina. Now, that's very interesting, given that a year ago, more than 1,500 people died in New Orleans. Would those people have died if the National Guard were not deployed to Iraq? Let's talk about what happened there a year ago. Astounding. The drowning of an American city in the 21st century. How did it happen? I mean, make no mistake about it, President Bush was fully briefed by video conference at his vacation home. They told him this could be the big one. This could be the greatest natural catastrophe in this country's history. This could wipe out New Orleans. Of course, he couldn't know that for sure. No one could. Sometimes it misses. But what is leadership about but to prepare for the worst and hope for the best? Did he immediately leave his vacation and perhaps go to Washington or closer to New Orleans to be in charge and command and control? No. Well, he did leave, but he went to California, and these pictures he allowed, pictures of him riffing on the guitar of the country music star Mark Wills, whose signature song is Wish You Were Here. Could have been the theme song of the people of New Orleans. And then he raced back to Crawford. But it wasn't just President Bush. Vice President Cheney, he was in Salt Lake City. He was in Wyoming. He was fly fishing. And when I was in Salt Lake City, we were celebrating KRCL Community Radio and working with Sam Weller's Zion Bookstore. A young man came up afterwards when I was signing books, which I'll do with you. And he said, you know, I was in Jackson, Wyoming last summer. And he said he worked in a sushi shop. And they're watching on television this remarkable, horrifying images of New Orleans. And he said he could not believe that Air Force Two remained outside, which meant Cheney was remaining in Wyoming. He said they shared a wall with the Secret Service for Cheney. And they weren't leaving, which meant neither was Cheney. His daughter, Cheney's daughter, was coming in for orders for the family from the sushi shop, and they were just in shock. But it wasn't just Cheney who didn't respond. Then there was Condoleezza Rice. She was in my city, New York. She was doing some high-end shoe shopping at Ferragamo, and a customer yelled at her, what are you doing shopping when people are dropping in New Orleans? And they took her out, the customer, that is. Then Condoleezza Rice went to Broadway, watched Spamalot. She took in a game of tennis with Monica Seles. And it wasn't just Condoleezza Rice. Andrew Cord, who was then the chief of staff, was vacationing in New England, the former GM lobbyist. That's right, what we see in Washington is the ascendancy of the oligarchy. You have President Bush, a failed oil man. You have Vice President Dick Cheney, the former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world. That's Halliburton. Condoleezza Rice sat on the board of Chevron for more than a decade. She had an oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice. Andrew Card, the GM lobbyist, the General Motors lobbyist. Is it any surprise that they are thirsty for oil and that that is determining foreign policy from Iraq to Venezuela. You know, the joke of the little boy saying to his father, "What's our oil doing under their sand?" And the letter to Brian, Carlos and Melita's son, younger son, goes on to say, by the way, offer a $20,000 bonus if he signs up. And it says, what can you do with that $20,000? You can buy a new car, you can pay off your credit cards, you can help your family, the money you earn in service of your country is yours to spend. And then it says, the decision you make today will affect the way the rest of your life turns out, which is precisely why Melita and Carlos are begging their son not to go to Iraq. But back to New Orleans. Something astounding happened with the Bush administration not responding to this catastrophe. That is, the corporate media did the right thing. They went to New Orleans to cover what was happening. And for one of the first times, we saw the corporate media reporting from the victim's perspective, because there were no troops to embed with. And it galvanized this nation, what we watched and read. You'd see bodies floating by on your TV screen. The Bush administration was quick to leap to action then. They tried to say, you are not to film the bodies, to which the editor of the Times-Picayune said, you have got to be kidding. And I remember seeing a young woman reporter. She was standing in the water. A man had come up with his boy and said he was holding his wife's hand in the attic. And as she slipped away, she said, take care of the children. He told the story, he turned around, and he waded off in shock into the water. And the young reporter started to cry. This is reporting from the victim's perspective. This is ground zero reporting. And the effect on this country, it didn't matter if you were conservative, Republican, a Democrat, a progressive, an independent, all of these labels washed away. It was humanity responding to humanity. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw these images in Iraq? We saw the babies dead on the ground. We saw the women with their legs blown off from cluster bombs from Iraq to Lebanon. We saw the soldiers dead and dying. For just 1 week, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. I wanted to tell you a T-shirt story. If you're regular listeners, you may remember Raed Jarar, the Iraqi architect, the blogger, who a few weeks ago came on our broadcast. He lives in this country now. He had a great blog called raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com, commenting on what was happening in his country in Iraq. Living in this country, he was headed from Kennedy Airport to San Francisco. And he was getting on his JetBlue flight, or so he thought. And he was surrounded by four people, transportation officials, TSA and JetBlue, two and two, as best as he could make out. And they told him he could not get on that plane wearing the T-shirt that he had on. Now, if you're anything like me, in the morning you throw something on, looks down, no stains, what's the problem? They tell him that his T-shirt is threatening. He was wearing a black T-shirt and it had white letters that said, we will not be silent. And he said, what's threatening about that? And they said, it's not the English, it's the Arabic script above it. And he said, that's just Arabic for we will not be silent. And they said, wearing a T-shirt with Arabic script onto an American plane today is like walking into a bank with a T-shirt that says, I am a robber. he said, is Arabic script a terrorist language now? Is Arabic a terrorist language? And they said he wouldn't be able to go on the plane unless he covered up his t-shirt. Now, he argued with them, but you know, he was in a dangerous place. He was in the airport, and who knows what could happen. He didn't want to be deported. Is this what he wanted to go down on? He was a taxpayer, he said, he had rights, but that's as far as he could take it. We called TSA, they told us it was the JetBlue employee who went and bought him a t-shirt. I think it said New York or I Love New York, something like that. And he put it over his t-shirt and they escorted him on the plane before the other passengers. Now, he had reserved early and he got a seat in the front of the plane where he likes to sit, but they escorted him to the back of the bus, plane. And then they escorted the other passengers on the plane. And that's how he flew back to San Francisco. So a few days later, we went with this story on Democracy Now! And the next day, you know, we work out of a 100-year-old firehouse just blocks from Ground Zero. We used to work in the attic, and now it's grown so much that we are building out the entire first floor where the horse and buggies used to bring the buckets of water. Being a part of an independent media center so we can continue to do this grassroots global work as you're doing with the remarkable Sanctuary for Independent Media here in Troy. It's really an incredible model. So the next day, these women came into our offices and they were in a big rush. They were all wearing this t-shirt, We Will Not Be Silent. And I asked them where they were going and they said they were headed to the airport. I asked them where they were going. They said, it didn't matter, they're just getting on planes. Now, in the next few days, the story got really big, right? NBC picked it up, ABC picked it up, you know, the story of Raed Jarrar. And we broke the story, and they didn't credit us. But that's okay, because the motto of Democracy Now! Is steal this story, please. We call it trickle-up journalism. When these women got back from challenging high-flying profiling, I invited one of them on the show. Her name was Lori Arbeiter. She's one of the artists against the war. And she'd actually given Raed his original t-shirt. She started giving them out and selling them on the anniversary of the invasion, the third anniversary, this past March 20th. It's amazing. We have been involved in Iraq just since the invasion, longer than the U.S. has been involved in World War II. It's amazing. So this was their little act, was to start to give out these t-shirts. But now with the story going so big, they are doing a very brisk business in t-shirts. There's nothing fancy. They have a website, I think, or you can email wewillnotbesilent@gmail.com and you can get a t-shirt. And they're translating them into all sorts of languages, into Arabic, into Farsi, into Spanish, French, into Hebrew. And now they're going to translate them into the original German. Why German? Well, it goes back to the White Rose Collective, World War II. A brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl. They were part of a collective of other professors and students. They weren't Jewish, they were German Christians, and they thought, what could they do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? They decided the best they could do was give out information so that the Germans would never be able to say, we didn't know. And they gave out a series of pamphlets, I think six in all. And the fourth one said at the bottom, we will not be silent. Hans and Sophie were arrested, along with other members of the collective, by the Nazis. They were tried, found guilty, and beheaded. But the motto, the philosophy, lives on today. It should be the Hippocratic oath of the media. We will not be silent. We will not allow others to be silenced. I want to tell you another t-shirt story, and it comes from right around here. Do you have a mall called the Crossroads Mall? Is either Roger or Stephen Downs here? Yes? You? Are you Roger or Stephen? Now, you have to help me. Could you stand up? You have to help me with a story because I don't want to get it wrong. You and your dad went to the mall right before the invasion?
Yes, I'm the dad.
You're the dad. You're Stephen. And you both bought t-shirts?
Yes.
Yours said, I remember it was something extremely radical. Peace on Earth. And your son Roger's a little more specific.
Let the inspections work.
And you put these t-shirts on?
Yes.
And you went over to the food court?
Yes.
So they go to the mall before the invasion, doing the patriotic thing. They go shopping. You go to the food court, and a security guard came up to you as you were eating?
Yes.
And said to you, you'd have to take off those t-shirts or you'd be arrested because there's no protesting allowed in the mall? Did you get put in handcuffs?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Is it true that you are a retired attorney with the New York State Commission on Judicial Conduct? Is it true that a few days later, 150 people wearing similar t-shirts descended on the mall?
Yes.
Are any of those people here today? Is it true that the security locked themselves in their offices? And the charges, Mr. Downs, against you were then dropped? It's a very great relief to me because we wrote about this story in our first book, The Exception to the Rulers, and I think I've told it every step of the way on this 80-city tour. So I'm glad we can speak truth to power. But I think it's very profound what you all did. I mean, first, Stephen Downs and his son expressing themselves, then standing up, and then all the other people who stood up with you. I was in Baraboo, Wisconsin a few weeks ago at the Fighting Bob Fest, and a girl came up to me. She was in high school, and she was wearing her high school sweatshirt, and it said, "Great minds don't think alike." And I thought that was very cool. We don't have to agree with each other, but it's very important that we all stand together to make it harder to target any individuals. It makes an enormous difference. I mean, since 9/11, thousands of people have been arrested in this country. We don't know their names. They don't know the charges against them. They haven't seen the evidence. Many have been deported. The most targeted right now are Arab Americans, Muslims, people of South Asian descent. It does not make us safer, this kind of racial profiling. In fact, it endangers us. When Raed's story went big, I was invited on MSNBC, and the host said to me, "In these dangerous times, don't we need racial profiling?" And I said, no, it actually hurts us. Because think about it. We will miss the next Timothy McVeigh if we engage in racial profiling. Think back 10 years ago, he gets arrested for the Oklahoma City bombing. It's clear he's worked with some other people. Did anyone suggest that all blond-haired, blue-eyed, white Christian men should be rounded up in this country. No. Because if you believe in law and order, and this is why I think these conservative and liberal lines are breaking down right now. If you believe in law and order, then you believe if there is enough evidence against someone, that evidence should be amassed, they should be charged, they should be tried, and if found guilty, they should be punished. But to round up, to target whole populations, not only does it alienate them, does it marginalize them? Here at home, it endangers us, and our standing in the rest of the world, and make no mistake about it, that matters. For others to see what is happening here is not good for us. Think about what we are coming to represent in the rest of the world. You know, when David and I wrote Static, the way books work, you write the book and then it takes time to be published, and you think, oh, these stories are going to be old. But it's as if we're telling the stories, writing the headlines today. Our first chapter is called Outlaw Nation, and we begin with the story of Maher Arar. He is the Canadian citizen who probably most people in this country have never heard of this man. I'd say 99%, maybe a half of the 1% are in this room who've heard of him. Canadian citizen who was born in Syria, lived in Canada for decades. In 2002, he's coming home from a family vacation, his wife and kids following a few days later. He was coming through alone because the computer company he worked for in Massachusetts, though he was based in Canada, needed some earlier work. He's making his way through Kennedy Airport, and he is taken by U.S. authorities into a New York jail, held for 2 weeks, and then he is deported to Canada, where he lives? No. He is sent to Syria. He is the victim of this extraordinary term, extraordinary rendition. That's White House for kidnapping. We know it from Latin America, disappearing people. He begged not to be sent to Syria. He said he fled when he was 17 with his parents. He hadn't served in the military. He would surely be tortured. But then he was put on one of these Gulfstream jets, what are being called now torture flights, and he is sent across the Atlantic. He cries all the way there. And sure enough, he is put in a grave-like cell. He's interrogated. He is tortured. He is held for almost a year. And as inexplicably as he was taken, he was released to Canada, a broken man. How is it that this is being done in our name? And it's certainly not just Maher Arar, but kidnapping, torture, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, Bagram, and these are the places we know about. President Bush himself has admitted that these black sites exist, these prisons where we don't know where they are in the world. Kidnapping, torture, illegal detention. Is this what we have come to represent to the rest of the world? Just think, if an American citizen, an American soldier, an American official is captured somewhere in the world and his captors say, we're going to do it the American way? This endangers us. And then you have, in the past few weeks, Congress, and now this week, President signing off on the Military Commissions Act of 2006, basically summarized, stripping, hypothermia, hooding are in, habeas corpus is out. How could this be? I don't know yet if President Bush also signed a signing statement alongside this one. He has signed more than 800 of them, but that's usually with laws he doesn't want to be beholden to. You know, these signing statements are quite astounding. He signs a law, but then quietly signs a statement that says he doesn't necessarily have to abide by it. Let's hope he signed a signing statement in this case. These are very serious times. September 11th, we've just passed the fifth anniversary of that date. And I want to just end by talking about that. I've talked about it here, I believe, before. But September 11th, 2001, Democracy Now! Was broadcasting when the second plane hit the second tower of the World Trade Center, broadcasting out of the attic then, no windows, didn't know what had happened. We're the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, just down the road. 8:47, the first plane hit. We broadcast every morning at 8, but then we were broadcasting at 9. And the first plane hit at 8:47. We didn't know what had happened, and we were preparing to go on. We went on the air at 9:03, the second plane hit the second tower. We still didn't know what was unfolding outside. We were doing a special that day on the connection between terror and September 11th, 1973, the day Salvador Allende died in the palace in Chile, as the Pinochet forces rose to power. The US-backed Pinochet forces, the Nixon-backed Pinochet forces, the Kissinger-backed Pinochet forces, the ITT-backed Pinochet forces rose to power, reigning for the next 17 years, killing thousands of Chileans. Just a few weeks ago, we had Francisco Letelier on. He's the son of Orlando Letelier, the Chilean diplomat, who a few years later, in 1976, with a young American researcher, Ronnie Moffat, were blown up by a car bomb. Not on the streets of Santiago, but on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. It's not the first time terror has come to U.S. soil, and not the first time that date was connected to terror. September 11, 1990, Guatemalan anthropologist Myrna Mack died at the hands of Guatemalan security forces, U.S.-backed Guatemalan security forces. And when I was speaking in Denver, we were celebrating community radio station KGNU. A Guatemalan family came up to me afterwards, and the mother said, "Thank you so much for talking about Myrna. She was my dear friend." To name someone is to give them dignity. September 11th, 1977, Steve Biko, founder of the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, was being beaten to death in the back of a van by U.S.-backed apartheid forces. He died in the early morning hours of September 12th. And when I was in Minneapolis, we were celebrating KFAI, Fresh Air Radio, I learned that September 12th is Leonard Peltier's birthday. And that day in Minneapolis, I met Mike Kuzma, who is one of Leonard Peltier's lawyers, and he that day had been in court arguing for the release of 90,000 pages in Peltier's case. Now, when they first tried Peltier, the defense had something like 1,800 pages. They thought they had pretty much the whole thing. It's now decades later, and they're appealing for 90,000 pages, and that's just from one FBI office in Minneapolis. They've been denied on national security grounds. It's 30 years later. September 11th, 1971, Attica, right here in New York, the prisoner uprising. Prisoners protesting prison conditions 2 days later. Then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller called out the New York State Troopers. They opened fire, killing 39 men, among them guards. And just in the last few weeks, guards' families were told they would get some kind of compensation. They were lied to at the time. There was a suppressed coroner's report that said that all of the guards were killed not by the prisoners, as the families and the public was told, but in the so-called turkey shoot when the troopers opened fire. 39 prisoners and guards killed, 88 critically wounded, hundreds of others injured. September 11th is not the first time terror came to U.S. soil. Ask any African American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. But September 11th, 2001 was a horrific moment. 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. We'll never know how many people died on that day because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death. And they were the undocumented workers who work at the World Trade Center. And we should know their names. We should know their stories. That's what dignifies a life. We stayed in the firehouse in those days after September 11th. We were in the evacuation zone. They had cleared everyone out, but we felt it was critical to keep broadcasting as the war machine geared up in Washington. And what was being projected to the rest of the world from Ground Zero, I didn't think reflected the sentiment in New York. You had those stickers that said, "Our grief is not a cry for war." I thought better reflected people's attitudes than a kind of blood-curdling scream for revenge. Thousands were gathering in the parks of New York with flowers and candles. And we were broadcasting people like Rita Lazar, who lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz. Rita was 70 years old, Abe was 56. He worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield in the World Trade Center. He worked next to his best friend Ed, who is a paraplegic. And as Abe's brother screamed at him on the cell phone to get out now, he said, "As soon as the emergency workers come and help me bring down Ed, we'll go down together." And they died with so many others. Or Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez, who lost their son Greg Ernesto Rodriguez above the 100th floor of the World Trade Center. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, which lost 700 of 1,000 workers. They wrote a letter, Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, to President Bush that swirled around the internet to say it would only increase their suffering to know that a mother and father in Afghanistan would soon lose their son. They said, "Not in our name, not in our son's name." Rita Lazar wrote a letter to the New York Times that actually got published, and she said the same. It would not decrease her pain to know that a woman in Afghanistan would soon lose her brother. She said, "Not in our name, not in my brother's name." And this nationwide movement grew up. September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And sometimes we saw them on television, and they would describe their loved ones. But when they move from description to prescription, what should happen, then the media cuts away, and they go to the terrorism experts, the Oliver Norths and the Henry Kissingers. Well, maybe the media got it right in that case. It takes one to know one. And I don't say that lightly. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the Iran-Contra scandal. Oliver North, you know, deeply involved with that, the illegal support for the Contra war, the Contras killing thousands of Nicaraguans. And now we are seeing in Nicaragua U.S. involvement in an election that is supposed to be taking place very soon. Daniel Ortega is once again running for president. Donald Rumsfeld was just there. And they were threatening the U.S. government if Daniel Ortega is elected, all U.S. aid will be withdrawn from Nicaragua. But Henry Kissinger, look at the record. Chile, thousands of Chileans died. Argentina, his support for the generals in the dirty war, tens of thousands of Argentines died. You look at Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, millions died there in Kissinger's involvement. You look at his involvement with Indonesia's invasion of Timor. In 1975, he goes with President Ford to meet with a long-reigning dictator in Indonesia, Suharto. They give the go-ahead for the invasion. 90% of the weapons used are from the United States. The Indonesian military invades Timor by land, by air, and by sea. They close the country to the outside world, and over the next two decades, they wipe out the population of Timor. They kill a third of the population, one of the great genocides of the 20th century. I do think that Osama bin Laden and his accomplices should be tried, and if found guilty, punished. But I also think that Henry Kissinger should be tried for war crimes. And that's precisely why the Bush administration, the White House, has been quietly and now not so quietly trying to revise the 1996 War Crimes Act. I'm not talking international law. I'm not talking Geneva Conventions. We know the administration has violated them over and over again. And also, make no mistake about it, it's not just the Bush administration. The Democrats have enabled this. They have hardly if you look at the invasion, the lead up to the invasion, the problem with the media is they reflect this narrow spectrum between the Democrats and the Republicans. And when there is no spectrum to reflect, well, it's unanimous. And they ice out most people in this country because that does not represent mainstream America. But here you have the Bush administration trying to change the War Crimes Act so that they will not be held accountable. In fact, in the Military Commissions Act of 2006 that President Bush just signed, they already give immunity for past abuses to those who've engaged in what many in this country would call war crimes. CIA officers now who go abroad are taking out insurance. We have to have a uniform standard of justice. It's not okay to say, if it's not okay for them in other countries, it's okay for us. It's not. Terrorism has one meaning. It is the killing or terrorizing of innocent civilians, whether done by individuals or done by states. In those days after September 11th, all those photographs went up all over New York, plastered the parks, the hospital walls, the park benches, the lampposts. They were taped on everywhere, thousands of Xeroxes of color pictures of loved ones lost, like a mother holding her child, and it would say, if you've seen my wife, please call her husband. She was last seen in Tower 2, and a phone number. Or a picture of a young man, if you've seen my son, please call his father, and a phone number. How similar those pictures were to the placards carried by the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina as they walk the Plaza de Mayo. Have you seen my grandson? Have you seen my granddaughter? September 11th united us with people around the world against terror. We come from the most powerful country on earth. We have the most powerful military on earth. What we do in this country matters, has a ripple effect all over the world. We now have a decision to make, not only in this period of elections, but every hour of every day, in every action that we take. We have a decision to make, whether we are journalists or students, whether we are housewives or employed or unemployed, whether we're doctors, nurses, teachers, media activists, artists, whether we're librarians or truck drivers or bus drivers, whether we're shopkeepers, whether we're at the beginning of our careers or the end, we have a decision to make every hour of every day, and that is whether to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now!